Amen.
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 Very good. Well, again, another installment of our show. We are going to start right away with a presentation from Sean. And then, you know, of course, Larry and Gary and I might chime in from now and again. But Gary has a few things he may add, and Larry will as well. So we're going to try to fill up the show with lots of great information. We are also going to try to revisit some of the chats that occurred on our June 26th show, as we promised. So there's a few items on there that we're going to bring up during the Q&A session. But other than that, I'm going to, there's a few other people in the lobby who like to come into the theater, so I'm going to let them in. So Sean, why don't you go right ahead?
Okay, thank you, Joe. What we're going to start with this evening is finishing up where we began last week with the Social Security number. Last week we covered various aspects of it. I'll give you a quick recap of it. Larry discussed the history of Social Security and how Social Security numbers were tied to the Human Rights Act or the Human Rights Charter by the United Nations or in the United Nations document and various treaties. And it was noted there specifically that those, by me, that those human rights, that Human Rights Declaration in the UN Charter was strikingly a lot like the Communist Constitution, where they guarantee all of these human rights to everybody that everybody's supposed to have over there in Russia. And the fact that they guarantee them doesn't, that's all they do is guarantee them, pretty much what this Human Rights Declaration does. As I said last week, let's ask the Russian people how that's working out for them. Anyway, Gary also had a lot to say about the Social Security number in regard to the Internal Revenue Service Code or the IRC and how that applies to those who it applies to, that it doesn't apply to United States citizens, that its use is intended for non-resident aliens. And he went through quite an enlightened program showing you the statutes behind all of this. Now, one thing I'd note about all of this, this idea that FDR came up with about his New Deal that he had and all the social engineering that he was geared up to do during the Depression prior to World War II, FDR had some real strong socialistic attitudes, that's for sure. And they exist in every country. They exist in every government. Every government has a tendency to engage in social engineering. And the United States does too. I mean, that's more obvious today than it's ever been before. That's just human nature, and that's government at its worst and at its finest. It's quite a dichotomy anyway. But, you know, in this country, even though the government engages in social engineering, the social engineering is tempered. It's tempered by the Constitution, the principles that were founded in the Declaration of Independence and announced under the Bill of Rights that are based upon liberty and freedom and individual rights of the people. And that's how social engineering is tempered in this country. We don't have communist country, we only have dictator country. And that's why when you take a look at these laws and how Social Security and these social programs apply, that none of them are mandatory. They simply aren't. It all requires your participation, as I pointed out last week in one of the exhibits that I had up. It was, I believe it was exhibit, the Scott exhibit. Let's see, which one was that? That was number 6, if you could throw it up for him, Joe. And that was a letter from the Internal Revenue Service. And basically what that letter said to Scott McDonald was that the Social Security Act does not require a person in the United States to have a Social Security number to work or to live. Now, they didn't make any bones about this. And as you go through the laws, as I pointed out last week, there are no laws. There are no statutes. There's nothing in this country which requires anybody to have a Social Security number. Now, the Internal Revenue Service has a take on that. They'd sure like you to have one. They refer to as a taxpayer identification number, which fits a broad scope of these numbers that the government issues. A taxpayer identification number can be a Social Security number, it can be an EIN number, TIN, by the way, is a taxpayer identification number that they use for non-resident aliens. And they like you to use this for identifying purposes when you file a tax return. In fact, they say that you're required to use it on a tax return. And they will penalize you a whole $50 if you don't use it on your tax return, because the requirement to have one doesn't exist. But if you have one, they want you to use it. And if you file a return, they'll fine you if you don't use it. That's kind of the recap of what we were going through last week. This week, what I'm going to get into a little bit more is going to be how the banks react to Social Security numbers. As you know, you go to a bank, most of you, if you've done it before, you go to a bank, you sit down, you open an account. It doesn't matter if it's a checking account. Doesn't matter if it's CDs. It doesn't matter if it's savings account. They want a Social Security number. Now, I've asked banks several times, what do you want a Social Security number for? Well, the government wants it. Well, I tell them, no, the government doesn't want it. The government doesn't require you to have to ask for it. It doesn't require me to have one to open a banking account. And they hem and haw and say, well, it's our policy. Well, okay, that still doesn't answer, why do you want a Social Security number? And generally the answer I will get from them is, well, we want to make sure that you haven't written bad checks on other accounts. We want to make sure that you have the appropriate, have good credit. We want to check your credit rating. We want to make sure that you're not running money for a Mexican drug cartel or whatever the case may be, or financing terrorist groups. So that's kind of why we want it. And so if I don't get it, what are you going to do? Well, we're not going to give you one. Well, why not? Well, because we require one, but we just went through that. You don't require one. Well, we have to have one. This is their game. They have to have one. The fact of the matter is, the truth of the matter is, they don't have to have one. And as I'll show you as we go through the exhibits that they rely upon, when they tell you you have to have a Social Security number to open a bank account, there's no such requirement. Taking the first one, that'll be Exhibit 2, Joe. That's called that exhibit is entitled the Bank Secrecy Act Anti-Money Laundering Examination Manual. You get that? That's an examination manual, and I do believe that it's probably created by the government, though I'm not sure. As you can see at the top of the document, it says Customer Identification Program, SCIP for short. You'll be seeing that acronym here as we travel through these documents. But nevertheless, this manual, which is not law, is that not right, Larry? Manuals, IRS manuals are not law.
But that is correct.
That's correct. They are not law. So as you go down through this manual, you'll see, it's highlighted in purple, I believe, what the manual tells you about this CIP or this customer identification program. They go on to say the CIP is intended to enable the bank to form a reasonable belief. Now, reasonable belief factors in here a lot. You'll be seeing it quite a bit. That it knows the true identity of each customer. Well, that's probably a good idea if you're going to hold somebody's money. A CIP must include account opening procedures. Now, they must include. It doesn't say it's required by law. That they don't say required by law, but it must include opening procedures that specify the identifying information that will be obtained from each customer. So they're leaving it up to the bank. The government's leaving it up to the bank to put these procedures together to be able to identify you to their satisfaction that you are who you say you are. It goes on to say, it must also include reasonable and practical risk-based procedures for verifying the identity of each customer. Reasonable and practical risk-based procedures. I'm not sure risk-based means. I think about it and think, okay, risk-based means because I come in and I look and I'm dressed like I'm a crook, or I look like a crook, so they must be kind of some kind of risk, or they don't know me, so I'm automatically a risk. What's the reasonable, practical, risk-based procedure based upon the way you look? I would find that hard to believe, but who knows? It's the government talking. Perhaps their risk-based procedures are procedures that diminish the risk that you aren't who you say you are. In other words, they can get enough information for you to decide, yep, this guy is who he says he is. It goes on to say, banks should conduct a risk assessment of their customer base and product offerings in determining the risk. Consider the risks. Consider. And they go on to say on the next page, the types of account, they're going to consider these factors when they decide the risk factor involved here in opening an account. The types of account offered by the bank, the bank's methods of opening accounts, well, that's what they're supposed to establish as a method. The types of identifying information available, get that one now. the types of identifying information available, in other words, what you can produce or you're willing to produce, the bank size, location, and customer base. I don't know why the bank size would matter, but I guess it does, including types of products and services used by customers in different geographic locations. So bank size, location, and geography matters. Makes you wonder what they have in their on their mind. Go on to the down to the next highlighted section in green. It says an account does not include. Now here's what an account is not in a bank. It's not a product or service for which a formal banking relationship is not established. In other words, you go in to get a cashier's check. That's not a product or service where a relationship has to be developed with the bank. As they say here, check cashing. They say such as check cashing, that's an established relationship, formal relationship, funds transfer, sale of a check or money order. Those aren't the things that are products or services for which established formal banking relationship. You go on and on to the next one, they talk about the CIP rule that applies to a customer. A customer is a person. You know, one thing about this manual that the government's put out, they never talk about a citizen, not one time. It's always a person or an individual, or it's an LLC or it's a corporation, but they never talk about a citizen. This matters if you've been paying attention to the webinars that we've been doing, where Larry and Gary have several times explained the differences between citizen, individuals, persons, and the like. When the government uses specific terms, they have a specific reason for using them. And when they don't use them, they have a specific reason for not using them. Anyway, they go on to say a person is a customer is a person, an individual, a corporation, partnership, a trust, an estate, or any other entity recognized as a legal person who opens a new account. I don't know. Does that sound like you consider yourself a legal person opening a new account? Their language is funny, to say the least. Anyway, if you go down to the end of that page, there's a footnote there, page 46, footnote 44. I find this interesting, so I'm going to read it quickly. The bank may demonstrate that it knows an existing customer's true identity, and that's just important, by showing that before the issuance of the final CIP rule, it had comparable procedures in place to verify the identity of persons who had accounts with the banks as of October 1st, 2003. In other words, they had comparable procedures or identifying you that are being suggested by the government. Though the bank may not have gathered the very same information about such person as required by the final CIP rule, in other words, it doesn't have to get the exact information they got from you in the first place, and they don't have to require it of other people, they can require other information to verify who you are, and they go on to explain. Alternative means including showing that the bank has had an active and longstanding relationship with a particular person as evidenced by such things as history of the account statements, information sent to the Internal Revenue Service about a person's account without issue, loans made and repaid, or other services for the person over a period of time. However, the comparable procedures used to verify the identity detailed above might not suffice for persons that the bank has deemed to be high risk. We're back to that high risk again. I'd like to know how they determine what high risk is. They really aren't clear on it. Going down to the next page, that would be page 47 at the bottom of the page. You'll see at the top of it, it says customer information required. Go ahead.
Sorry, the problem is I think I only have the first page of the stuff you sent to me, so I'm not able to go to those succeeding pages.
Okay, I'll just wing it here.
Okay.
This is exhibit two. But in any event, the information that they're requiring from their customers is this. It's pretty simple. A name, date of birth for individuals, back to individuals again, an address, and an identification number. The footnote, when they talk about identification number, explains an identification number is something like this. An identification number of a U.S. person, okay, person, not citizen, is a taxpayer identification number, or evidence of an application for one. So if you don't have a TIN, a taxpayer identification number, which by the way, does include under the Internal Revenue Code a social security number. If you show that you made an application for one, they're supposed to consider that part of verifying your identification. And an identification for a non-US person is one or more of the following, a TIN, a passport number, and the country of issuance, an alien identification card number or a number of, or a number and country of issuance of any other unexpired government issue. They go on to tell you where the TIN is identified in the Internal Revenue Code. The point is this. This is something that they suggest. They don't say this is required by law, that they have an IRE, that they have a social security number. They say it's required to have an identification number. That's not true. This manual says, the title of this particular section says customer information required. But as we go on here, you're going to find out that simply is not true. This manual has quite a bit of information under it. The thing is you go on to this, through this booklet, through this manual that the IRS or the government has put out, and one of the sections is called lack of verification. And it states, the CIP must also have procedures for circumstances in which the bank cannot form a reasonable belief it knows the true identity of the customer. In other words, if you can't provide the information the bank has set out in its policy, they have to have alternative procedures. And here's what they describe as alternative procedures. They don't describe it right here, but I'll tell you what their internal procedures are. They get whatever, any kind of identification they can get from you, picture ID, whatever the case may be. In the absence of a social security number, they can get a residence address. They can accept proof of your utilities bill. And as they said previously, they can accept an application that you're applying for a TIN number. But one thing I want you to know, if you don't give them a TIN or a social security number, they can still open the bank account, but here's what they're going to do. They may very well do it. They may issue a suspicious activity report to the IRS and say, we opened a bank account, maybe, you know, against our better judgment, but we did it anyway. And just to let you know, we did it. We're giving you a suspicious activity report. So if you want to look into this person that we've opened a bank account for, you can certainly do it. The main thing is there is no requirement for an identifying number. The next one that we relied upon when we put together this research paper that was done on the requirements of a social security number for a bank account was called same part of the manual, but a different part of it was the Bank Secrecy Act, Anti-Money Laundering Examination Act. Now this deals with the Patriot Act, and it gives you some excerpts from the Patriot Act, and it talks about how they require foreign nationals to apply and obtain an account for domestic financial institutions and how they want an identifying number for them. But nowhere in here does it say that under the Patriot Act, and they don't say it does under this manual, that a social security number can be required from a United States citizen in order to open a bank account. We'll go on to the next one. That would be Exhibit 4, Joe. And here again, this is also a paper, not a government paper. This is a white paper issued from a person named Katie Iverson. She claims to be an attorney acting for ATT US Technologies. And her idea is to explain to the bank how they're supposed to comply with the Patriot Act and other acts of Congress in order to open a bank account and to implement their customer identification program. And here are the four, again, in this manual that's written, again, it's not the law. Their identifying procedures begin with a two-step process. First, they say you must provide certain identifying information. They really don't tell you. And then the agency or the bank must determine the validity of the documents. And your minimum, again, as the manual said, is your name, your date of birth, residential or business street address. Now, that wasn't in the last one completely. It just said address. An army or fleet post, box office number, business or residential address of next of kin or other contact may be substituted for your residential business. Or your residential or business address. And again, they say a business number or an identification number. It goes down to say on page 3 of this white paper that was written, it says for US customers, both individuals and entities, a CIP should, not that it's required by law, but they should require a taxpayer identification such as a social security number, individual taxpayer number, employee number. Doesn't say they're required to get it from you. Doesn't say the law requires them to ask it, but it's something that they should do. In other words, it's a suggestion that the government is making. And there's another document here, and this would be number 5, Joe, if you have it, which is, again, also written by a woman called Lucy Griffin. She's a BOL guru. I'm not sure what BOL stands for right now. And she also explains that under the new rules, under the Patriot Act rules, that the CPI must require the collection of certain basic information and steps to take that they take to collect and verify that information. Now, here's what's interesting about this paper. Here's what they say about the identification process and alternative methods. She lists them, that verifying customers' identification with documents. For an individual person, two forms of ID with pictures. That's it. That's what she says there. She goes on to say, for a business, corporate documents or business license. She goes on to say, verify your supplemental identification with non-documentary methods, such as state whether or not the bank will accept customers without documentary proof. Now, this is the procedure the bank is supposed to put together and tell the government what they're doing in order to verify who you are, to know their customer. State whether or not the bank will accept customers without documentary proof. Now, think about that. The bank has to tell the government whether they will accept a customer without documentary proof. Why would the government want to know that if you're required to give them documentary proof of your identification? That wouldn't even be in there. So banks can accept you walking in there and saying, hey, I don't have any documents to prove who I am, but I can prove it by other methods and give me a bank account. They just want to see something that they know who you are. State what alternative methods of identification are acceptable. They have to tell the government, you know, if I'm not going to ask for a social security number, I'm not going to ask for a tax return or something else, I do have alternative methods in place to ask them what they can produce to prove who this person is. It doesn't have to be a social security number. State whether the bank will open an account with documentation to be provided later, particularly tax reporting ID information. Call the customer, visit the customer, drive by their location, verify the address they give you by using various directories. Contact third parties to verify the information they've been given to them. The point is this, you don't have to give a social security number and they don't require that you do. It just is a matter of bank policy. The question is, when you go in to get a bank account, how far are you going to push in? How are you going to go about educating these people that, hey, wait a minute, I don't have to give you a social security number? And how far are you willing to push the envelope to tell the bank that, hey, wait a minute, if I can identify myself to your satisfaction, you don't need the social security number. I think it's something we need to push back. But keep in mind, and this is important, if they open one for you, all of these manuals suggest the same thing. If they fail to give you a social security number, if your customer fails to give you a social security number, you should, not that you're required to, but the bank should notify the government through a suspicious activity report that we gave a person a number or a bank account without a number, and we want you to know about it. So one way or the other, the government is going to know about you. The IRS certainly is going to when they get the suspicious activity report. But again, this is what they should do. These are recommendations. These are suggestions. Going through this entire research that we put together, and the summary that we created, it was about exhibit number 1, Joe, if you can put it up. It's exhibit 1. It's about 3 pages with footnotes that explain various statements that were made in this summary of this report that was taken to a bank and said, here's the deal. And here are the documents that show you're not required to ask for a social security number. I'm not provided to give one. If you want to ask for one, you can. If I don't give one, you can still open a bank account. There's no law that says you can't. In fact, there's alternative methods. And all of these manuals that I've been discussing are all encapsulated and incorporated in this 3.5-page research paper. So the bottom line is if you don't have a social security number and you want to open a bank account, there's no law that requires the bank to open one for you. The only question for you becomes this: how far will you push the envelope in order to force the bank to give you a bank account outside their so-called procedures of asking you for a social security number? Is there discrimination here? I don't know. There's all kinds of discrimination in the United States today. You name it. There, name it. Anybody put an adjective before it, it's somehow discriminatory nowadays. Is this discriminatory against citizens that don't have or are not required to have social security numbers, and they can't give you one because by law they're not required to get one, and therefore you're going to deprive them of a public service? Is that discrimination? I wonder. I wonder how far this could go if the bank was pushed on it, and how they would defend against it in court. These are interesting questions. But the whole purpose of this is to let you know there's no requirement to use a social security number to open a bank account. It's just bank policy. So there you have it.
Sean, there's a gentleman, Mark, asked an interesting question regarding domicile and residence and opening a bank account. Let's say hi to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Well, okay. Does residence instead of domicile in the bank document have any legal implications under the tax code and the Patriot Act? No, that's a good question. I'm sitting here, I'm reading from manuals, okay? Manuals that are created by lawyers or people that have probably little understanding of the delicate nature of these terms and the true intent and meaning of these terms. Under statutes and under law, these terms can have very specific meanings for very specific purposes. Domicile can be different. Residence can be different. A person can be different, as opposed to having an individual or a citizen. They can all be different. But when they write these manuals, I look at it from a realistic point of view that these people really don't have a clue of the nature of the terms they're using, and they're making an assumption that residence and domicile are the same thing. And if you call them on it, they say it means the same thing. Now, as a matter of law, depending upon where it's used and how it's used, that's not true, is it, Gary?
Not true at all. In fact, there's a big difference between residence and domicile from what I know.
Well, why don't you give them a treat?
Domicile means your intent, where you intend to live. You can only have one domicile, but you can have more than one residence. A residence is where you go, and this is according to the tax laws. A residence is if you leave your domicile and go to some other place for a period of time to accomplish some purpose, and you're there for a while, that then becomes your residence. But you always intend from your residence to return to your domicile, which is your permanent home.
And, you know, in the regulations to Section 1.1-1B says to everyone, all citizens of the United States, wherever resident, are liable to the tax. So residence and domicile happens to be very, very important. And if you don't understand whether you're a resident or your domicile, I think that'd be a good starting point to learn more about the code.
Yep, when it goes to Internal Revenue Code, I couldn't agree more. But again, I want to clarify, when you're reading these manuals, I don't believe they make a distinction between residence and domicile. If they did under these manuals, they'd be using both terms as opposed to just one. I don't believe the people that are writing it even have a small understanding of what Gary and Larry just said. I don't believe they could grasp it until they read a few more things.
Wouldn't it be a fair statement that even as Gary brought up the language, wherever resident, and I'm not looking down my nose just because I happen to have had good teachers like all you guys and others, but when they say wherever resident, it has a sound of like everywhere, right?
Wherever you live.
Whereas legally, it actually has a whole different meaning than what most people take it, but the IRS is thrilled that you'll take from that language oh, they must mean everybody, I'm sunk. When in actuality, if they could distinguish the difference between domicile and residence, it would have a whole new, not a new meaning, but a new meaning to them, right, Gary?